Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Language revitalization takes dedication, and we have two people who have demonstrated their commitment to keeping their languages alive. It took decades for Roberto Barrero to gather the information compiled in a new dictionary for the language spoken by the Taino people. And Elena Talate is turning a lifelong passion into a fledgling program to revive the language for the Caddo Nation. We'll talk with both of them coming up after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. South Central Foundation of Alaska is using federal grant funds to place a school nurse and behavioral health consultants at three rural schools that do not have them. It's partly in response to high rates of suicide, especially for youth. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has the story.
McGrath, Nikolai, and Takotna will now share a school nurse. Those are small communities in the Yukon Koyukuk area in the interior of Alaska. They'll also now have behavioral health consultants. Donna Acey is a manager for South Central Foundation.
Some of the things we would like to address that have been brought to us not only by the school, but maybe the administrators and staff would be reducing barriers and accessing care. We're trying to meet some of those high suicide rates with some behavioral health services and just support the overall well-being of the student in the community.
AC says the nurse will be based in McGrath and they'll visit schools in Nikolai and Takotna quarterly or more often as needed. She says the nurse can provide basic care and referrals, and she says having a nurse in schools can help kids get care without their guardian needing to travel or take time off work. Danny Kapinski oversees South Central's rural behavioral health team. She says the behavioral health consultants will visit schools in person at least quarterly. They'll also be able to schedule telehealth appointments with students in between visits. She says the consultants can also run workshops at schools that help with mental illness prevention.
Teaching students at a young age to understand what their emotions are really helps them to then be able to identify as they're growing, you know, how they're managing, what's going on for them. They might be more willing to talk about what's going on since they have the words to use and know how to express themselves.
She says that can help reduce substance abuse and suicidal ideation later on. And she says it can keep kids in the classroom more, which helps with academic success. South Central Foundation hopes to begin the program before the end of the school year. It's the first time they've run a program like this. But if successful, they hope to expand it to other rural schools. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
In California, plans to open a new gateway to Redwood State and National Parks got a big boost recently, paving the way for a parcel of land to be returned to the Yurok tribe. The place is called Oru on Highway 101, about 40 miles north of Eureka, at a former lumber mill site. Yurok Chairman Joseph James says this is a model for the land back movement.
It's not driven by Western society providing interpretation. It's being driven by Yuroks.
The area is closed for construction, but will reopen in 2026 as the Oru Redwoods Gateway with new trails, cultural signs, and visitor facilities. Redwoods National Park Superintendent Steve Metz says this is the first co-management agreement for tribally owned land with the National Park Service and California State Parks.
So this is just a recognition of their sovereignty, their need to regain land that was taken from them 2 years ago and turning it back and creating greater understanding about the original people in this area.
Future plans include a visitor center with a tribal village with plank houses and a sweat lodge. University of Arkansas Little Rock Assistant Director and Archivist of the Sequoia National Research Center, Aaron Fair, is discussing Native American views on the solar eclipse. She's taking part in two speaking events this week ahead of Monday's total solar eclipse that will cross North America. Fair says with the more than 500 federally recognized tribes in the U.S., there are different beliefs regarding solar eclipses and traditional stories with cultural narratives that vary. She says this is a great opportunity to learn about stories, traditions, and perspectives. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian Higher Education Consortium, working to ensure tribal colleges and universities are included in our higher education system. Info on 35 tribal colleges and universities at aihec.org. Skugtash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The language for the Taino people is getting a new boost from a comprehensive language dictionary. For two decades, Roberto Mucaro Borrero parsed through historical documents and other written texts to reconstruct a reference for a language with no fluent speakers. The Caddo language is also getting a boost. A recently formed language program in Oklahoma seeks to revitalize the language with only two fluent speakers. The program is led by Caddo tribal member Elena Talate. She is a graduate in linguistics and Native American studies from the University of Oklahoma. During her academic training, she drew from hundreds of tapes and written notes in her efforts to formalize the language's structure. Now she's dedicated herself to bringing the language back to her community. We'll talk with these two dedicated native language speakers. We also want to hear from you. Do you have a language warrior in your community? What is the state of your native language? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And a reminder, you can also comment on our website or our social media pages. Speaking with us now from New York is Roberto Mucaro Borrero. He is cacique of the Guainia Taino tribe and president of the United Confederation of Taino People. He is, of course, Taino. Mucaro, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Ahom datiao and taigwe itiaono diri mukaro agwebana boriken taino daka. Just thanking you, brother, for having me back and just greeting all the relatives and just letting them know my name, as you mentioned just before, but sharing it in the classic Taino language.
Appreciate those beautiful words there, brother. Also joining us today from Binger, Oklahoma, is Elena Talate. She is a member of the Caddo Tribe of Oklahoma and also the language preservationist for the Caddo Tribe. Elena, sister, it's great to have you join us as well. Welcome.
Oi, sidat wawa, kumbakiha manha'ahat, kutsiyatsa na hasine hayano hakiyaba, atsiyatsa na ha'ime kunamita, sina ha'ime ya eyaki kusina. Thank you, Sean. Appreciate you having me on. I just introduced myself in the Caddo language, and looking forward to our discussion today.
I am too, Elena, and I really appreciate those beautiful words that you share with our listeners. Let's get this conversation started now. And Mucaro, we're going to start with you. Tell us, what inspired you to write a dictionary and grammar guide of your tribal language?
Well, thank you so much, Sean, for the question. I think that beyond my own inspiration and searching, there was a real desire from the community to really come together on language and have something to put forth for our future generations. So there was a number of projects that had started, as you mentioned, a couple of decades ago, actually, but they never really got to fruition, and they never really were able to get to the point where we are now with this new publication. And as a younger person during that time, I listened to the community, I participated in those discussions, and I was really interested because at that time my focus was a little bit more creative and focusing on the music and dance of Taino people, and it was important for me to share words in the songs, and I wanted to be correct in that. And so I started working with elders in the community and community leaders to work on that. And I had put out what was the first traditional style Taino music album in 1994, starting on that project. And that really got me motivated to learn more about the language. But as I started to look, I started to see a lot of discrepancies. As you mentioned in your introduction, there was no fluent speakers, meaning that Taino was not spoken as a separate language within our community and the island of Boriking, which people know today as Puerto Rico or any of the Caribbean islands. But there was what we've since termed kind of a hybridization between Spanish and Taino. And depending on where you were in a certain island, that hybridization could be much stronger, where there was a lot of uses of Taino words and syntax, ideology, et cetera, that was mixed in with Spanish. So it wasn't a straight Spanish that they were speaking. It was really this kind of hybrid. And so looking at that, beyond some of the historical texts that I started to go through, I also started to look at studies on colloquial languages in the island, meaning just what I was talking about, how people were using words that they didn't identify as Spanish in everyday speech. And so that really assisted me on the way. But that was really it was really those early interactions of the love of music and of culture that started me on the process. But over time, I really got more inspired because I really felt that we could really bring back this language. There was certainly enough there. I mean, thousands of words, either still straight Taino or Hispanicized a bit, still prevalent throughout the islands in identification of flora and fauna. And we also have, fortunately for us, neighbors who speak, who are part of the same overall language family, part of the Arawakan linguistic group. And there are fluent speakers still in those related languages. So we were able to really do a comparison and see that what was documented from our ancestors in those early encounters over 500 years ago were still those syntax, grammatical framings, etc. They were still being used in some of the neighboring related languages, so we can make those correlations. And that really helped us set the path for this publication that is not just a dictionary, but it also provides a bit of history. It shows the reader how we derived and what it took to go through this process. And we also do real comparisons to those neighboring languages that I just mentioned, so that they could actually see with their own eyes the relationships. And we do have some grammatical introductory information in there, so that could help folks actually start to manifest the language beyond just reading words or saying particular words, but actually being able to engage in some conversation now.
Well, this is exciting to hear how comprehensive this work is, not just a dictionary, but you mentioned the historical and the grammatical information as well. Mukaro, several times already on the show, I referred to it as the Taino language, but I just want to make sure, is that the right way to describe the language, using the word Taino?
Yeah, well, we say Taino because it's part of us. We are Taino. There's a lot going into that specific word, and we get into that a little bit in the dictionary. But what we learned during this process was that it was recorded very early on that there was a major language that was spoken throughout the islands, and that was the main language, and that's since been identified as classic Taino. And the reason why is because it was used in a lot of this diplomatic speech. It was used across the islands. It was used in the expressions of the social ceremonial manifestations that took part in the communities at that time. But there were also some dialect differences. And so what we tried to do here is really focus on the reframing and the representation of the classic Taino language, that could be accessed across all the islands so that it was not just from one particular community, but it had elements from all these communities, and that we can incorporate what was left in each of the islands to build up this classic Taino language again. So yeah, we can say Wahia, Taino, we speak Taino, or we can add other words, like we could say we speak the Taino language, or things of that nature. But the way we express it now, we can say, we can use the word Taino to identify ourselves in the language.
Okay, now you mentioned different dialects of Taino. About how many different dialects are there?
Well, we found at least three. And when I say dialects, meaning that, let's say one word might be pronounced with a T sound on one island, and it might be that same word identifying the same item would be used in the beginning with an S sound, or something that might sound more like a wa would actually have a little bit of a hardness in front of it, or a G sound like gua or gua, right? So there's that happening. And then the other factor that we found that was really interesting, and that really speaks to the history of the region, and I think more about the history of indigenous peoples overall, is that we also found pre-arrival of Europeans, then that's important, pre-arrival of Europeans, evidence of incorporation of words that were not even part of the linguistic family, meaning the Arawakan family. We also found elements incorporated from the Carib languages or the Caribbean languages, where you get the word Caribbean from. And this speaks to the amount of interaction these nations had before the arrival of, as I said, Europeans in 1492 or BC, before Columbus. So, that was fascinating to us, because in the historical documents, there's often a trend to portray the Carib language speakers and the Arawakan language speakers as fierce enemies. There's this, like, this good Indian, bad Indian dichotomy that was presented in the historical documents. And it really sets it up like, okay, so these Caribs were the man-eaters, and they were eating their way up, eating Tainos, and the Tainos were the peaceful ones, and they were more ready to submit. And it's this kind of like
romanticized
that's presented by these colonists. But
okay. Mukaro, I'm sorry, we're going to have to take a short break here. We come back, we're going to talk more about this project that he's working on. Stay with us, folks. A conflict more than a century ago changed the course of events for the Ute and Paiute nations in what is now Utah. A new exhibition explores the tribal perspectives of what is called Posey's War that led to dispossession of traditional lands and forced boarding school enrollment. We'll hear about the exhibition and the accurate accounting of history on the next Native America Calling.
This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. You can kickstart your career by joining thousands of AmeriCorps members in the Vista program serving to alleviate poverty. AmeriCorps members help organizations make change right in their own community. A service opportunity that fits your ambition can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. We are hearing from two dedicated language speakers who are working on revitalizing their tribal languages. And we also want to hear from you, our listeners. How does your language inspire you? What challenges do you see facing tribal language programs where you live? Share your comments and questions by calling 1-800-996-2848. We've got those phone lines open now, folks, so give us a call. We'll get your comments on the air. 1-800-99-NATIVE. And a reminder, you can listen back to this show and past shows on all major podcast platforms, such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can also listen to other Native programs by downloading the NV1 app to your smart device. Our first guest today, Roberto Mucaro Borrero, is explaining a project that he worked on to develop a language, a written dictionary language project for the Taino language, and also a grammar guide. And Mukaro, we had to take a quick break there, but you were talking a little bit about these historical documents that you worked on. And tell us a little bit more about what those documents were. Are we talking about church records or Spanish colonial government documents? What actual data were you able to draw from?
Yeah, there was quite a bit of data. You have what was termed as the original chroniclers documentation, meaning that you have journals from colonizers like Christopher Columbus, and then Bartolomé de las Casas and Oviedo and others. There's a lot of written information about these early encounters where they actually record language and some phrases and a few sentences. And you know, that was really helpful. I just want to finish up with this thought that I was just sharing before the break. But one of the things that we found when we were analyzing these languages was the input of other indigenous languages that were not even part of the related languages. And that was important because it shows that those who were writing the history in the very beginning were also giving their own spin on it and giving a particular character to the narrative that was really opposite of what was actually happening between our people. We could see that in everything from the way they accused our relatives of being cannibals, and they mistook that for secondary, they mistook the secondary burial rituals for cannibalism and so on. And so even that tension that they said between the Caribs and the Taino was not really the way that they had portrayed it. But yeah, there was a host of documents there that were from the very early encounter period. And then in subsequent years, there was scholars, non-Indigenous scholars, who looked at this issue and also tried to rework or represent. But again, these representations of the language was really just chock full of bias and religious bias, racial bias, the way they described their people as primitive, savages, etc. So we had to look at all those words and even the definitions that they attached to those words, relook at them and represent them from an indigenous perspective. In other words, the spiritual beings that our people interact with in the Caribbean, we use the term semi. But in those Spanish documents or the French documents or even some of the English documents, they were referring to those same entities as devils, right? And so that's not what we want to put in our presentation because that's not what we want to teach our children, those perspectives. We really wanted to bring them back to the indigenous perspective and really present that in a way that we feel that our ancestors would be proud of and would be smiling about today.
Well, this just really makes your work all that much more impressive, that not only did you compile this dictionary, but you had to actually wade through these historical documents and analyze them as such. And just as you said, wade through this bias and come up with a fair and accurate assessment like you did. So really, congratulations on such a fantastic piece of work you've been working on. Let's take a caller now, Chanupa, who is listening on Keeley Radio. He's in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Hello, Chanupa, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for another brilliant show, Sean. Before I go further, this is to that brother, that Kaino brother. I've been in their area of the, the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico many years ago. I learned how to drink a real beverage called, this drink was called papaya over there. And it's a real made from fruit. But what I want to contribute to the show, my little brother, Devin Oldman from the Henanahena people in Wind River, and then Johnny Three Fingers from up there in Lame Deer, okay, the Titista people, and me as a Lakota. What I want to contribute to that, brother, the only way we can always save in language, whether if you write it, please don't kill the meanings of it when you write it. We always say this in our Lakota virtues. Wo Lakota lila o techike. Champetu onji, wo washka iachu hunta, wamakashka hena wichoe kile nahachti oisfapi. Meaning that our animals are still hanging on to our language. Written and whatever illustrations people do, they kill the meaning of them. Like the buffalo, they'll say, okay, they growl like that, and people can't catch it. What he's really saying is, meaning standing shoulder to shoulder, and which buffaloes to this day still do. They put the calves in the center, the cows around them, and they circle the whole herd to protect them from harm's way. That's what I want to contribute, because, Sean, you're always having a great show and with language and every other thing, and that's what I want to contribute from the Pine Ridge Indian Reserve.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Chanupa, for those warm words. And, yeah, our producers, you know, they work hard to put these shows together, line up these guests, and get these topics slated so our listeners enjoy the content. So, Chanupa, appreciate those words. And, Mukato, I'd like you to respond, because you referenced that a little bit earlier with regard to the animals and the natural elements and how those factors also apply with your work in writing the dictionary for the Taíno language.
Really thanks that brother for sharing, and it really touches me deeply, the words and the feelings that he expressed from the animal nation there, because we felt that too when we were doing this work. And you know, although I'm listed as the author of this, I had a lot of help. You know, I didn't do this alone, and we had to do this incrementally. It was a real community project, so I really have to thank the UCTP, or the United Confederation of Taíno People Language Committee. We had Nova Saigo, Heriberto Martinez Guaguaniki. We had Tai Pelli, Ana Yuisa, and just a great group of folks would come in and out as they could over the years. And we really worked together and looked and spoke to people and had consultations with elders and found obscure writings and really shared, listened to people who were using words that were not even really found too much in writings, and it was all fascinating. But the other thing that I want to point out, what makes this dictionary and grammar guide a little bit different, is that each entry in that dictionary has a source. There's a lot of information out there that is questionable these days, especially when it comes to our language. And what we wanted to do was make sure that the reader came away with a sense that what they were seeing, everything had a source. And even if they were words that we had to restructure and put them into that universe that we had created because of all this work we did between the historical documents, the comparison with the neighboring languages, and we had the ability now, because we understood the syntax, to actually incorporate more words that were not even written down in a source, but that totally make sense within the universe and that are accurate within that context, because now we understood a little bit more about the language. So where we did that, we highlighted that too so that they understood. And then because this language was written down in Spanish, English, French, etc., we would put our simplified spelling format in there as the word, as the first entry. But then we also list the way you might find it in other sources, so that if you say, wait a minute, this kind of looks a little different from what I've seen, then you'll be able to understand, because it might have been a Spanish writer, it might have been a French writer who wrote this word. And so, you know, all those things really lend to the credibility of this particular publication. And then finally, the other thing that was really just so heavy duty in this book was that all the plant and animal references, where we see those, you ever see those Latin scientific words that come after a plant or something like that, those are called taxonomic identifiers. We went through all of those, and we found so many errors in them. Some of these things were not there. So now each plant in there and that taxonomic identifier associated with that word is now correct. We went through the really hardship of fixing that, and nobody's ever done that before. So that really will add to other projects, like when we do our ecological projects and really identifying what plants go where in the ecosystem, because it's not just about language, it's about rebuilding our whole culture, and we see it tied to our development, our land back. All of that is all part of this.
All right, Mukato, thank you for that overview there. Really fascinating conversation we're having here on Native America Calling today about language revitalization efforts. And let's take another caller, Maria, who's listening on KNBA in Anchorage, Alaska. Good morning, Maria. You're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to call in and acknowledge the work that the Alutiiq Museum is doing down on Kodiak Island, because they have spent a lot of years trying to preserve and save our language from the, I think, just over 100 elders that they had started out with in the early 2000s working with to compile and document our language. And as I was growing up, they came out with, you know, different leaflets and information and the Alutiiq language posters, and the Alutiiq Cultural Week came to our schools, and we were able to do, you know, beading and root collecting and weaving and all these different things that we were able to learn thanks to this revitalization that was happening. And they have, in the last few years, been able to open an Alutiiq language preschool where preschoolers are being taught in Alutiiq, and they're able to bring that home to their families. And I'm seeing my cousins being able to connect with their babies and speak together, and it's just so great to see. And they've also compiled a college course with coursework and a book for the Alutiiq language. One of the biggest things that I've seen in the last few years is that more people are coming to call themselves Sukbyak, which means a real person in our language. Alutiiq is derived from Aleut, because that's what the Russians came over and were calling us. But April Lactonen Counselor, she's been a big part of the language revitalization down there. And to quote her, our people, they Alutiicized it and created Alutiiq out of Aleut. So more people are coming to call themselves Sukbyak from learning of our history and what we were originally calling ourselves. That's what they have documented that we called ourselves, not the Russians coming. So I think the Alutiiq Museum down in Kodiak is doing some great work, and I'm very thankful and proud of all that they're doing. Thanks for all the work, everybody.
Yeah, Maria, really appreciate that call. And what you're describing, I mean, that's the goal. That's the goal of all these programs, is to promote not just the language, but the culture, and get communities and families involved, like Mukaro described as well. So really appreciate that. Maria, calling in from Anchorage, Alaska. Let's head south now to Binger, Oklahoma, where we have our next guest on the line, Elena Talate, and she is the language preservationist for the Caddo Tribe. Elena, hello again, and thanks for joining our show. And let's talk about the Caddo Tribal Language Program that you are a part of. When did it start?
Hey, Sean. Our language program started not too long ago in August 2022 when the Caddo Nation hired me. The Caddo Nation tribal government in the past had a cultural preservation department that Caddo language fell under. But when they hired me, it was the first time, I think, that they had hired somebody whose job was solely to focus on our language.
Now, you studied some of these language topics in school. What else made you uniquely qualified to take on this role? And what was it that excited you about the challenge, Elena?
That's a great question. Well, I would say most language workers will think that they're not qualified to do what they do. They just really care about trying to do their part. When we get started on this, we think it's such a huge, overwhelming task. It's an enormous challenge. But it is helpful to remember that we're never going to see the fruit from the seeds that we plant today. That's the idea, is that all of the labors that you put forth, they're gonna help generations beyond your time. And that's a motivating factor for me. I love to imagine a world where little kids are speaking Caddo as their first language again. Part of my education was at University of Oklahoma. I studied Native American studies with an emphasis in tribal languages and cultures. And there I learned about different second language acquisition and Native American language revitalization techniques. The program was kind of a hybrid between linguistics and Native American studies. And I really enjoyed it. I gained a whole lot of skills. And most importantly, I gained a whole lot of connections when I went to school. I was really happy that this program at the University of Oklahoma had attracted so many people from so many tribes who all cared about the same thing, trying to gain more skills so they can go back and help their communities. That's where I got my start academically. But when I was growing up, I didn't have any speakers in my family, but because they had all passed away when I was really young or before I was born. But there were some speakers in our community, and I remember, you know, hearing our language on just a rare occasion as I was growing up, thinking it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard in my life, and that I really wanted to do that. And so today, part of my job, I do some documentation style work, just like our Aino friend just described, gathering together all of the academic or historical resources, old language class notes that were held in the community in decades past, centralizing all those resources and sharing them, redistributing them, and circulating them to our community members, most importantly, for free.
All right, Elena, we're going to talk more about this program and the work that you do, but we do have to take another short break. So, listeners, if you want to join this conversation, give us a call.
Support for this program provided by the American Indian Higher Education Consortium, the collective spirit and unifying voice of 35 tribal colleges and universities. For over 45 years, AHEC has worked to ensure that tribal sovereignty is recognized and respected, and that tribal colleges and universities are included in this nation's higher education system. Information on a tribal college or university near you at AIHEC.org.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce, and you still have plenty of time to join this conversation about language revitalization efforts. Join us with your comments and questions at 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. That's the number to call to share your thoughts on the air. We'll get you through. 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we're talking now with Elena Talate, and she is the language preservationist for the Caddo Tribe of Oklahoma. And Elena, you were talking about poring over these documents, and we heard similar experiences from Mukato. And I also understand that when you were in school, you went through a lot of resources, cassette reel tapes, VHS tapes, and notes from your family as well. So you're no stranger to poring over documents, it sounds like.
No, not at all. It kind of comes with the territory. I think that what I do diverges slightly from what Bogado does, in that we have the preservation aspect, but we also have some living speakers. It changes the situation a little bit to where part of my job is, you know, trying to do archive management and gather together old resources, but also produce new resources. Spend time with elders, recording them, interviewing them, and organizing Caddo language events where people can come together, learn, and share our language. Even though there's only two what I would call truly masterful speakers left in our tribe, there are dozens of partially fluent speakers where they grew up with Caddo in the home, but for one reason or another, they didn't fully acquire the language, usually because they ended up going to a school where it was English only. That's when things really changed for all of our communities across the United States and Canada. And so that one of the missions, you know, of our language program here is to try and reinstate that intergenerational transmission of our language from elders to kids and make language a part of our homes and a part of our communities again.
Elena, I like how you refer to these people as truly masterful speakers. Some other tribes, they'll use the word fluent or fluency. Why do you avoid that term?
I think that fluent doesn't suit our purposes very well, because it puts people into just two categories, either you speak or you do not. And that's simply not true. You know, there are people who may be able to speak, you know, at length about all different types of topics and use, you know, have really abstract concepts, talk about things that are complicated, you know, create new words. Those people have a firm grasp of the language, but there are, I believe that language speakers exist on a spectrum where there are speakers who might be rememberers, usually older people, usually the children of fluent speakers, to where they can understand the language and recognize it. They know lots of words and phrases, and maybe they even know lots of songs. And so these people are still, we can't write them off as not speakers, because the role they have to play in bringing our language back is so, so tremendously important.
Elena, that makes so much sense, the way you describe it, like speakers on a spectrum like that. I think that is so accurate. And I think so many Native people who are, on, like you say, on different aspects of that spectrum can relate to that with regard to language. Let's take another caller, another person listening in Anchorage, Alaska, on station KNBA, Helena. Good morning, Helena. Welcome to the show.
It's Helena, but thank you so much. Yeah, I want to thank the panelists for the work that they do, first and foremost. I'm actually the only speaker of Saskatoon Tenu, which is in Alaska. So we're at the very beginning project. And so I had two questions for the people on the radio. One is, how did you get interest? Because it's it's a dormant language. And for the second question, there's a lot of funding that are for languages that are not dormant, so I do feel left behind. So how did you do that for your project? Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Helena. Great questions. Elena, go ahead and respond to that first question there. How do you get people fired up? How do you get them interested in learning the language and getting involved with your program?
That's a really great question. And I think the answer would depend on who you ask, but it also depends on the unique challenges that face our communities. Some languages are dormant, like our caller mentioned, and they need different things. Something that helped my community, you know, just speaking from what I've seen in the past year and a half working here at the Caddo Nation, I think people got really interested when people saw what's possible. There's some people who might be hesitant to begin because they don't know, well, is it worth it? You know, that sort of stuff. They're afraid to begin. And for people who are in that situation, or there's people in their community who are thinking that way, I would say, don't wait to begin. You know, just go for it. Don't ask for permission. You know, go get those blessings, because the only thing that can happen from you trying to learn your language and share your language is that you'll be blessed. So I think that for our community, people really got interested with when we started teaching the kids stuff, because when they saw the little kids running, playing, speaking their language with their teachers or to each other, and singing songs, it warmed their heart and made them think, that's so amazing. I want to see that more.
Right, right. So, and they probably
started, for anybody who's getting started, I would say just go for it. And, you know, as long as you're sharing it with a good attitude, other people will see that attitude, and it'll be contagious. You know, positivity is infectious.
It sure is, Elena. And probably what they also saw with those children is they saw the future and recognized the value in what you folks are doing. Our caller had another question. And Mukaro, I'd like you to respond to the second question that Helena up in Anchorage has. And it had to do with regard to funding and how much funding is focused more towards languages that are not dormant, that have, you know, large populations of speakers. So what challenges do you folks face there with regard to getting adequate funding for a language that just doesn't have the large numbers of speakers like some of these other languages?
So, but it's a reality, right? And I think that that's one thing that was very beautiful about this project is that there was a lot of labor of love. There was a lot of hours of volunteerism that came before we were actually able to show people how serious this project was and to actually get some support later on down the road, which helped us put the project in the final phase, which was to get this publication out. And this is the first part of the final phase of this particular part of the project, because this dictionary that we've been talking about right now is English Taino, but we're also going to be releasing this year, probably in another 2 months, the Spanish Taino, so that we have actually more people able to engage with it. And then we'll start in our next process, which is the actual lessons, putting together the different materials needed to really move this forward in the way that we'd like to see it go. But yeah, it's always an issue. We've run into that quite a number of times, but I think that if you look at the book and you see some of the other initiatives that we've had, like how we motivated people using social media, doing projects like what we called Taino Word of the Day, and that really got a lot of traction on social media, and that was able to generate some interest. So a lot of people really want this, and I think that's the difference, right? From young to old, people are like, we really want to see this language come back. We've had access to part of it. As you mentioned, it was dormant, but it was always there because it was mixed into the colonial languages that we spoke. And so people really want to see it come and stand on its own again.
Well, Mukaro, thank you for responding to our caller's question. Let's take another call. We have time for Arlene listening on KCIE in Dulce, New Mexico. And Arlene, hello. I understand you are a Jicarilla language teacher. And you work with kids in Head Start.
Yes, I work with kids from ranging infancy to toddlers, 5-year-olds. I teach them at this JCFEC, Jicarilla Child Family Education Center here in Dulce. I've been doing it for 11 years, and we, during the times that I teach them, I would have them sit around in circle time, and we would go over our colors, numbers, seasons, foods, bangojia, verbs, names, greetings, counting from 1 to 20. The little ones are counting from 1 to 5. The little ones would sit on the floor in front of me, and they would repeat all the colors. And they even familiarize the colors. But I'll tell them in Jicarilla, where is red in the room, and they will point to red in the room or orange or whatever. They know how to say their numbers real well, and we always go over their different body parts from eyes, nose, ears, mouth, everything that they have. We talk about different things, and we talk about our ceremonies, about the gojia and things that we have to do, and our clans being red and white, Lanero and Oyero. I've been doing this for 11 years, but when I was younger, I learned from my elders how to say the different words and everything. I would sit in front of with my elders and talk with them in Jicarilla and be fluent. I took the Jicarilla language proficiency test at the culture department here, and I passed it as a fluent speaker. I go around the town here, and I talk to the elders. And they understand what I say, and I am able to converse with them. Mm-hmm. We have our language written out to where I can use it in the classroom. And I believe that it's being a big benefit because the kids are learning to say words. The infants are learning to speak. The toddlers are learning to say words. And if they can learn our language and carry it on that way, I think that's a big benefit for our tribe.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Arlene. Really appreciate your call coming in from Dulce, New Mexico, Jicarilla Apache Tribe. And just great calls today. Great conversation. Elena, I want to go back to you. We've got a couple of minutes before we have to wind up the show. But there was recently an Oklahoma Native Language Fair, and some young Caddo speakers got first and second place. Tell us more about that fair and about those young speakers.
Yes. So every year in April, the Sam Noble Museum in Norman, Oklahoma, hosts a Native American Youth Language Fair, and it attracts hundreds of submissions from all over Oklahoma and the country. Basically, it's 2 days of events where kids from all different tribal programs can showcase their abilities and their talents in their languages. There's many categories the kids can compete in, from mobile videos, skits, poetry, spoken prayer, songs, you name it. Every year the fair grows and grows. I would encourage anybody, whether you live in the state of Oklahoma or outside, to submit to the fair. It's wonderful to see so many kids from all of these different tribes speaking their languages, and it raises a lot of people's spirits. This year was a great turnout. It was excellent. I really enjoyed volunteering and judging this year. But also there was a little group of kids, Caddo kids, who went. They studied hard and sang a traditional song. They sang a modern song. And they sang some hymns. And they submitted a storybook. And they all placed. I was very proud of all of the kids. So if you're interested in participating in the fair, you can check out the Oklahoma Native American Youth Language Fair on Facebook or on the Sam Noble Museum's website.
All right. Thank you for that information, Elena. And, you know, just listening to you describe this fair and meeting other language enthusiasts and specialists like yourself, what do you learn from those conversations, Elena, from folks also working on language revitalization programs, not only in Oklahoma, but other states as well?
That's a wonderful question, Sean. Something that I really appreciate about the Native American language workers field is that it's kind of small. Everybody knows each other, but we are all really dedicated to seeing each other win. You know, a lot of my colleagues actually became friends and family members, mentors. They took me in under their wing and they said, here, this is what you got to do. You know, this is how you apply for a grant. This is how you do this language learning technique, or this is a way you can modify your lesson plan. So I wish that I could say that most of what I have learned came from college, but it also came from other language workers who, their support has always meant the world to me. I would not be where I am without their help, and I hope to be half of the teachers that they are one day.
All right. Elena, really appreciate your words of wisdom today and how much you learn working there in the community. It just really is inspiring to hear you, as well as Mukato, who joined our conversation to talk about his efforts with the Tainu language. And we also appreciate the callers who joined the conversation today. Great insights as well from Alaska and also from Jicarilla Apache in New Mexico. Listeners, please join us again tomorrow. We'll be having a discussion looking back on a conflict referred to as Posey's War that changed the course of events for the Ute and Paiute nations. Until then, have a great rest of your day. I'm Sean Spruce.
Support from Dartmouth College, hosting its first Tribal Leadership Academy August 4th to the 10th in New Hampshire.
up to 25 new or appointed tribal government leaders, and a group of experienced presenters will consider intergovernmental relations, economic development, healthcare, natural resources, and tribal law and order. Dartmouth College will cover the travel and attendance costs. Application available at dartmouthtriballeadershipacademy.com. Application deadline is May 1st, 2024.
Orik mashat or ibdak mashat. New put at the ibdak, mamdam sapo gugu sidat. A mashaka paichum bohimat, dihai chochuk for that amok kudu sadak. Ibdak mumkidak, pom some chugum famira. Am go wom nyoka gugu dab amjidak of famira. Doki. By just much of amjid, moniga, mama came up on mea. A monig healthcare.gov. A moya gugu, the mamako gigi, sikor, like hamako gigi, go kutus homok jud. Idop amjid him of Medicare to Medicaid hachipkan.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.